Hello, my name is Jen Hickey. Welcome to the WEN podcast, a series of conversations with people as they share their WEN moments. Recognizing these times can change our destiny, help us to stop hiding behind the past or clinging to a future that may or may not happen. This podcast is about recognizing the power of the WEN moments. Welcome back to the WEN podcast, guys. So this is the last episode in the second series. And we are finishing up with Stuart Wilson. And this week we are talking about anxiety and peer pressure in children and teenagers. Please visit his website for more information, zestlife.ie. And thank you once again for all your support during this podcast. I've really enjoyed it and really look forward to connecting again with you soon. Dealing with a child that is suffering with anxiety. So can we go back to that? Because you're dealing with, say, a young teenager. I presume it's going to manifest extremely different in a young teenager than an older teenager. And can you spot, what are the symptoms of a child with anxiety?
Yeah, so I suppose, generally speaking, it depends what way anxiety is manifesting. So usually questions that I would have when I'm working with parents to find out a history for young people who are coming to us, depending on it being age appropriate, of course, but typically you're kind of, say, mid-teens, 13, 14, 15-year-olds. Generally speaking, if there's an underlying anxiousness, we'd be asking questions about when that started. What was it like? How did it manifest? You know, are we talking about an attachment-related issue? In early years, was this child stuck to your leg when you were going into school and never wanted to part from you? So is there an actual anxiousness attached to attachment?
As in when they were a young toddler, there was always kind of something simmering.
Yeah, and that's, listen, that can be quite appropriate because every kid doesn't necessarily want to go to school the first time, but mostly when kids get into it and develop a friendship or two, they're then the first typically few days of school is hard to get them in, but then after a few days they're fine and everything is grand, and typically the teacher is ringing you to say that child I dragged off your leg at the school gate is having the crack and in the sandpit right now, so don't be worrying, all is well. So that's natural development. I guess for a more anxious child, in many ways, what we start to see is that that doesn't become the normal. And they struggle a little bit on being on the outside of social interactions in school. And when you go to PT meetings, the teachers are communicating this back to you to say, we're seeing some signs that your child is having some issues around anxiety. And really, we try and work with the school. So if you were connected into a therapist on that, you might say, well, look, the way to go on that might be connecting with somebody in play therapy or art therapy to help children understand that two things are important. One is to be able to communicate and process how you feel. And kids will do that in one of two ways, Jen. They'll do it verbally if they are kids who are able to process at age appropriate, verbally, one-to-one primary connection, or they'll do it secondary. And what I mean by secondary is they might do it through art or through play with a therapist. Or very often it's a bit like, you know, when you're driving the car and the kids are in the back, and they're chatting away. You can have all sorts of conversations with them and they nearly forget you're there. And it's because that's done in a secondary manner. You're not quizzing them, sitting them down and asking them about their day, because they're just going to tell you it was fine. They're telling you all about their day when they're driving or if they're eating or if they're, you know, doing something with you. So anxious kids in general quite often will display signs of having difficulty fitting in with their peers. And rather than, again, ignoring that, it's really good to be able to communicate with the teacher, because usually in primary school, that's one teacher, to be able to talk about that and see what is it that we can do. Is it an academic issue? Is the child finding it difficult in school? Is there an educational psychology report required? Are they meeting all the milestones? And if there is, we can get them the right supports, and then they pull back in line, all as well. There's no problem. I struggle with even sometimes the milestones, because we kind of have this rhetoric of, you know, the child is doing great, they're normal. And I'm like, whoa, that's a dangerous word.
That's normal.
I hope no child is normal. I hope every child is unique, and that we can try and almost want our kids to, I suppose, fit in and be normal like other kids. What we really want is for our kid to be the best version of them and then happy in their uniqueness. Everyone is different. So I guess the anxious kid is something that we probably see some early signs of, and as they get a little bit older into being their sixth class, first year, it tends to peter out a bit, where they start to fit in more or just find that one or two other friend who can then start to make them feel less anxious, if that makes sense.
Can anxiety manifest itself as anger? So a child, say, coming home from school, being very angry.
Yeah, I mean, the common symptoms, generally speaking, anger, frustration and anger in kids comes somewhere from a department of feeling rejected or disconnected. Dan Siegel, who's American psychiatrist, talks about this in his book, The Whole Brain Child, where he talks about feeling isolated or lonely as children will produce extreme emotions. And that can be extreme sadness, extreme anxiety, and quite often the symptoms of that, behaviors of that, because kids are working out of a different way out of their brain. They're not working out of the cortex, they're working out of the reptilian brain. They will show you the emotions of that to try and communicate that. And that's often anger.
Okay, so it's not like your child is going to be coming home, you know, being quiet or anything. That can manifest itself, obviously, in loads of different ways.
Very definitely, each child is different, but it will come out, and it's good that it comes out. It could come out in avoidance, you know, going to their room, quiet, not talking to you, not wanting to talk, or it could come out in anger or frustration. The important part of that is not to ignore it, to try and create that couch time with your kids, to be able to have those conversations. And from a maternal context, I often say to mums, you'll get the worst of them and the best of them. So have those conversations with them maternally in couch time and see if you can tease out of them what is it that they're feeling, what is it that they need, and try and assist them with that. And it might be that, you know, I'm quite slow to bring kids to therapy, that really this can be done at home.
Yeah.
And we try often to assist parents to know that what they're seeing is okay. And here's some of the things you can do that will really help that. And if the kids need to or want to come in for some assistance therapeutically, fine, we can do that. But really it's to try and resource parents and help them.
Yeah, because I think, you know, because not all kids will want to. Not all kids will be saying, no, I'm not going anywhere now, I'm grand. So I suppose it's empowering parents to be able to connect. Everything just comes back to the relationship every single time, doesn't it, really?
It's incredibly important. And one that I had this in my clinic this morning, in conversations with parents, I had a fabulous dad come in to talk to me about his teenage son today. And he's asking me, what is it that I can do to improve things for my son? And I love parents having those conversations.
Yeah. So what is it that we can do to improve things?
And part of the conversation that I had with him was, well, first of all, have you had that conversation with your son? Do you know how do you know that he absolutely feels loved by you as a dad? You know, what is it that you're doing that makes him feel that way? And he was able to bring in some amazing gestures of what he does for his son. And some of them are big gestures, like take him away for football matches and trips and all sorts. And I'm like, okay, that's cool. Have you asked him, what are the small things that I can do for you on a daily basis? And he, no, actually, I haven't done that. And I said, so ask him. And another great question to ask him, wait for the answers and change your behaviors according to his requests. So it might be, well, dad, you know, when you come home from work and you walk into the kitchen and you make a beeline for me and go, hey, son, either high five me or hug me, that makes me feel wonderful because it meets my needs for physical touch, because that's a love language of mine. By the way, if any parents listening haven't done that, Gary Chapman's book of 5 love languages, really helpful to be able to understand what is it that your kid needs, their language of love. So if their language of love is words of affirmation or physical touch like a hug, then don't do it the way you had it, because that's not what your kids need. Do it the way they need and meet them there. And I got this wrong on 3 of my 5 kids. So that shows you how much I know. But when I did the test with them, it was brilliant. So it means I can meet their need for love in the way they need from me.
I love that.
It's brilliant and so simplistic. And listen, this was a great conversation with my marriage, never mind my kids.
But look, and I will actually, I'll get the name of that book off you at the end. Because the one thing, and I'm assuming this is kind of similar. So, because 2 of my kids are now, you know, pretty much finished growing. I mean, they're adults. But I think when they were younger, when I look back, I think I was probably trying to parent all 3 of them the same. And it was only when I realized, really, and thankfully did realize, that Jesus, they all need completely different things. And you can't parent all your kids the same. You have to kind of look at the differences.
I had that conversation with one of my kids the other day, and they corrected me in this. All kids are not equal in how we parent them, they said. It's not equality they're looking for, it's fairness.
Justice.
Actually, that conversation led on to a great outcome, which was I think the single most important thing in our family homes is mum and dad's relationship. I know I've said this before. It's critically important. And actually, one of the conversations I had, again, with that dad in the room today was to say, ask your children, this is brave, but ask your children, what do you think my relationship with your mother is like?
Oof, wow.
And ask your kids to describe it.
And it's important what they see as well, isn't it?
Oh, listen,
we don't
ask that, Jen, unless we're willing to listen to the answers and not be offended by them. We have no right to be offended if we're going to answer those questions. So if our kids say, well, actually, you can be a bit of a twist that at times, or, you know, you can be gruff in the way you do this. So we need to hear them. And then the second part is we need to ask our kids, what can I do to show you or to assist you in my relationship with mom being even better? And I mean, then, of course, go and have that conversation with your wife. But listen to what your kids say, because the relationship between mom and dad is the garden in which the kids grow up. And if that is the truth, which we all know, what's that garden look like?
Mm.
You know, are we intentional about, you know, making that garden sacred and using metaphors? Is it nice? Is it peaceful? Is it calm?
And if they're worried about mom and dad's relationship or whatever way the interaction is, that's going to bring on a whole level of anxiety.
And look, I'm really aware there's going to be people listening to this who are single parents. There's going to be people gone through separation. You know, I totally understand that. And I know that may be difficult. You might be listening to this thinking, okay, well, this is all very well for you and what you're saying, but I'm a single mom at home with two or three kids, or I'm a single dad at home with two or three kids. What do I do and how can I do that? Remember, first of all, that those conversations are still important, and those relationships, even with their biological mother, etc., are still important. Doesn't mean that we can't role model new good relationships, but it's really important that we understand how to communicate with them about the significant other people in their lives. And some of the best communications I've had with separated parents on that has been where kids have said, listen, my mom and dad separated, yeah, but goodness me, they loved each other and continue to love each other. And oh, I never heard either one of them ever speak bad of the other. Now, that might be, again, oversimplistic, and you might be listening to this, somebody at home thinking, yeah, but he was a twit or she was a... And
well, I suppose it takes time to get there, doesn't it, really? I mean, if a relationship is broken down, it might not immediately appear great, but over time...
And patience is important.
Yeah. And as well, like you and I, you know, we didn't grow up in an era where our parents sat us down and asked us how we were doing every 5 minutes, or can we help you? So if you are, well, I think number one, if you're listening to this, it means this is the first step. You might not have the tools because it might not have been done with you as a child, but, you know, if you're not feeling that you're able to connect, it might mean just doing a little bit of work on yourself, perhaps.
I think that's right. And I think the important thing to remember in our minds is when I work with young people therapeutically and with families, there's three types of parents, really. There's what we would call your receptive parents who want help and they're like, thank you, this is brilliant, this will help me, I'm going to use this, and I might come back to you again, get a little bit more advice, blah, blah, blah. But they're receptive in what they do and they take it on board and they work with their kids. There's generally parents then who are non-receptive, who would be, they just don't really understand or get it, but they're open to moving into being receptive with the right assistance, scaffolding and nurture. You know, they'll take on board what we've talked about and they'll try their best to bring that into the children's life space, you know, where the child lives. They'll try and improve things. And then truthfully, there'll be some parents listening to this who will say, that's not my experience. I'm listening to this as a mother and this child's father is hostile, or it might be a father listening to this saying their mother is hostile. And we get, Jen, let's be honest, we get hostile parents and kids who are living in the environment of hostile parents. And I have to say to any parents, you know, listening to this, if you can, there's no judgment in this. But we've got to get to a place where we're taking ownership of that and saying, if that's the truth, my kids are kids and I'm an adult, I can make cortex, context, decisions and choices that can change that. And it's never too late.
Yeah.
Decide that and I can improve that. And let me tell you, it literally changes the garden in which your kids are growing up in, and it's never too late.
Yeah. And it can be, you know, it can be a small change that actually turns into just a massive change in their environment. Do you find that under the umbrella of kind of anxiety in kids, adolescents, that kind of thing. When we talk about children's friend groups or peer kind of relationships, what's going on there in terms of anxiety, if, like you were saying earlier, about children feeling left out or lonely?
Yeah, and remember, this age appropriate, because obviously when you get into first year, I mean, the first year is that madness of going into a big school and whatever that would look like, and it's difficult for kids to find their feet. They start to get in, they usually have a massive friend group, and then that starts breaking into smaller friend groups as they go into second year and third year. Remember this though, you know, kids when they're really young, toddler years, remember how embedded they are in their relationship with their parents. Everything is done through their parents, play dates, etc. And then all of a sudden they get into first year and there's what we simply call a disembedding.
Yeah.
And it's correct. It's right. Yeah,
and for parents too, you're like, oh my God, all of a sudden there's no involvement. You don't know anyone, meet anyone.
Listen,
for anxiety to parents.
My youngest daughter, Tamara, is just hit 11. And I mean, gosh, I know it's illegal, but if I could freeze her, I would.
I know.
I want her to grow up. She's fantastic. And even when she makes the odd mistake in her English, I'm not correcting her. I just wanted to stay, you know.
I am clinging on for dear life because Jed is 13. And, you know, if I get a moment to even, I won't say put him to bed because he'd probably shoot me, but if I, you know, tuck him in, it's like, yay. Result.
He's going to love you for that one. You're right. And this, remember, this 13 or 14 year old is starting to disembed from their parents. What does that mean? They're moving away from their major connection through mom and dad to being a little bit more dependent. We call that moving into like an interiority phase, which is finding their own feet, finding their own little bits of independence, and finding ways to get that independence. Quite often the way they do that is inappropriate. They'll fight with mom to get that independence. They'll sometimes be rude or be curt in the way they communicate. And we've got to correct those boundaries and try and assist them with that so that they do it correctly and properly.
But how do you do that? So your child's being rude, your child's shouting, you know, whatever. And all of a sudden then you're in this fighting match. And look, you know, it happens all the time in our house and I don't want to be that one screaming. But what happens when it does? I immediately just take the phone. This is like the only bargaining tool I have left. And then it's like all hell breaks loose because I've taken the phone. And I know you're talking about red zones. Do we come back to that? Is it that moment where you've got to try and catch yourself?
Jen, it's the hardest thing in the world. And the reality is, yes, we have to catch ourselves. And we have to, as they say, a beautiful comment, a friend of mine from the North, they said, catch yourself on. I love that. We need to catch ourselves before we head into the red zone. If you come home from work and you're tired and you've had a tough day and your kid's there screaming at you because they want to go out, remember that everything happens after you screaming back is not good. And then you're suffering more consequences of the red zones. So interiority, where the child is trying to fight for independence and freedom, mom is looking for respect in the home, and dad's doing what dad needs, which is dad's looking for his peace and quiet. That's the way a household works. Dad feels peace and quiet if mom's getting respected. Usually the first thing dad will do is jump in when mom's being disrespected. And we get kids then fighting for their independence, and it goes around in the circle.
Yeah.
It's a circle of madness, and it doesn't work. It's a red zone mayhem. And what we've got to realize is, firstly, the child pushing the boundaries is interiority, and it's a developmental process that's correct.
Okay.
Secondly, rather than stay there and fight them, say things like, rather than you're being a cheeky little monkey, I'm sure there's better words that you would use, you're being disrespectful, rather than doing all that, show them and model them how we can do things better. What do we do? I'm feeling really upset with the way I hear you communicating to your mother. She and I are going to walk away right now, and we are not going to listen to that kind of behavior. I'm finding myself getting really heated in my responses to your inappropriate behavior. That, to me, that is not acceptable, and I'm not putting up with that, and I'm walking away from you. It's all me. I'm taking ownership for my emotions.
This is how I'm feeling.
I'm feeling this. I'm walking away. One, you're role modeling the correct behavior, and you're hoping that at some point in their future, before their 50s, that they start doing the same. But we've got to be able to show them the correct way to deal with those emotions, remembering that you're the only one, you and your wife, in the room at the time, if it's a husband and wife, you are the only one in the room with a fully developed brain.
Yeah.
So what they're going to say or do, let them do it, walk away. In most cases, when I talk to parents, Jen, their reaction to me is, when I ask the question, when you've had a red zone, how long does it take your young person before they come back to you and either say sorry or just nuzzle up to you in that child way where they don't say sorry, but they're being affectionate? And most parents say to me within the hour, you know, some cases 20 minutes.
And if you're getting that apology, it's so important to be able to accept it, I'm assuming.
The apology, if they nuzzle up beside you and go, you know, sit on the couch and, you know, show you a little bit of affection or something, they're realizing they did wrong. And what we do then is if they reach out to maybe literally put their head on your shoulder when you're watching the TV, you know, put your head on their head. Be nice, be careful, be loving, show them that forgiveness is a part of a fight. And then now you're out of your red zone. Then we're in a green zone. And okay, it's something as simplistic. The next words that come out of your mouth as a parent are important. Is everything okay, love? And let them talk. Because there's probably not. You got to remember whatever's going on in their world that day. You know, you described your son at 13. I have a 13-year-old. 13-year-old is not half a 26-year-old. A 13-year-old has 13-year-old problems. The 13-year-old peer issues. And listen, don't they have peer issues at 13? Oh my goodness. Hear them, let them talk. Try and help them by just asking good questions to create their own solutions so that they're calming their own anxiety. Because if you remember when you were 13, every issue that ever happened was catastrophic. And every person who wouldn't talk to you is, you know, or who let you down by not turning up to the shop, or it was a horrendous feeling. And that feeling of rejection often comes out in anger. Who takes that anger and absorbs it? Mom.
So it's, as opposed to trying to fix it, it's more of a just, oh my God, that sounds awful. I hear what you're saying. It must be really painful. That type of dialogue.
Listen, I can remember, I think one of my kids was about 7 at the time. And, you know, she came home from school and her first reaction was using language that I didn't like. I can't even remember the kid's name. I better be careful to use a name that's not the right name, or one of the parents listening to this might think I'm talking about their kid. But it was something like, you know, Daddy, I hate Sarah. And I'm like, oh my goodness, that the hate word. Don't use that word. I wanted to correct her and make her right. And within seconds, she's saying to me, you know, she's so mean. She said this to me. And then within another couple of seconds, I'm going, oh my gosh, is my child being bullied? I'll head down to school and deal with this. And she was like, she's so mean. And she said this. It's not the first time she said it. Now I'm going, oh my gosh, it's repeat bullying. And I listened to her and I just said, that sounds terrible, love. Tell me more. And she just kept going on about it. And then after about another minute of ranting, she turned around and said, you know, I know she's going through a really hard time at the moment, but I'm never going to be her friend again. And I'm like, oh gosh, that sounds like it's been really hard. And then she said, yeah, it's been real tough because her mom and dad split up recently. And maybe she's just having a really hard time about that, Dad. And maybe, do you know what? Maybe she just needs a card. I'm going to go upstairs and draw a card, Dad, for her. And I'm going to bring it into her tomorrow. Bye.
And it's all sorted then the way she wants it. I mean, you know, our kids come home like that, and I can 100% relate to everything you just said there. And then when they go to secondary school, and like we said, you're not really meeting the parents. What do you do if you feel your child is suffering from some sort of peer pressure, perhaps in a group that they're actually not able for, you know, but they need to be in this group? It's the world. And you don't like the group. And, you know, we all want to be able to pick our children's friends, but clearly that's never going to happen. So, should you just back off and let them plow on in?
Yeah, look, it's a balance. It's really difficult because you've got to, you know, you've got to try and help and advise our kids in many ways. But really what I would try and do is the peer groups and the movement amongst peer groups. Unless there's bullying, Jen, or unless there's significant stress, pressure issues that need a parental guidance or parents to address.
So if they were being bullied, would that be very obvious, do you think?
You'd be watching out for it, because bullying, generally speaking, you know, kids can avoid talking to parents about it, but you'd be noticing things in general behavior. Like we talked about with disordered eating earlier on, you'd be talking about what kind of things are happening that are leading me to feel there's something up with my child and I don't know what it is. And that's where, if we're concerned about kids' general wellness and we just can't put a handle on it, or they don't want to go to school, or we're in school refusal, or those kind of things, that I would say parents seek help. And it might be connecting with, you know, therapeutically with somebody to get some guidance and signs to look out for. Or it might be connecting in with the year ahead in school to say, are you noticing anything, or with their form teacher. And it could be that the communications or names that they used to use a lot are silent now. They're not using anymore. But trying to tease it out in couch time is helpful. And it might be, rather than sprinting down a road with a child, are you being bullied? Is there something going on? It's more, you know, I notice I'm not hearing Sarah's name being mentioned anymore. Is everything okay there? Talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah, because we probably get too involved as well, maybe, as parents. I mean, obviously, if there's bullying going on, that's something that needs to be dealt with. But aside from that, you know, your friend, the child's friend group, we probably should just let them at it to a degree.
I think my first thing to say to parents is, if you're concerned about bullying, is I have an absolute zero tolerance to that, and seek help, get help, and move quickly. So I would very much say that. Secondly, if it's peer groups and the normal enough behaviors within peer groups, the most, I think, singly important thing is to create an environment in which it's open for the children to talk, you know, first year or second year, to talk to mom or dad about it and feel like they've somewhere to go with it, that they're not holding it on their own. I'm a great believer in, you know, even if there's older siblings within the family, that they would talk to somebody within the house. And if an older sibling was worried about their younger sibling, that they'd come and talk to mom and dad about it or something, you know?
Yeah, so they might not open up to you, is what you're saying. They might open up to an older brother or sister.
Yeah, or it could come through like a mentor, it could come through a sports coach, it could come through a ballet, you know, teacher or whatever. It can usually have somebody in their lives that you can trust and they can trust. And you can promote that as parents, you know.
It must manifest very differently in an older teenager. So go to, just before we finish up, because I know you're very good with your time, like 17, 18, 19.
Yeah, and I think the thing you'll start to see more in 17, 18, 19-year-olds, and I know you and I both have kids within that kind of group, is to know that keeping connection with them is really important. Their relationships tend to move from being big, big peer groups into being more about small connection, you know, really close groups. So they don't tend to have quite so many of the really dramatic upsets within the group because it's less amount of people. But equally, if there is a falling out, it can tend to be a much deeper one because it's almost like a best friend disconnect, if that makes sense. And I think we'd spot those behaviors quite quickly because we'd notice them, you know. Mary or whoever, Frank or whoever, isn't around as much anymore. Has something happened? It's to be able to try and create the safety net for our kids to know they can come and talk about that if they're struggling. Because a friendship group change like that, Jen, it's catastrophic when you're that age, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I, at that age, just so many pressures. I mean, like, they seem to be under massive pressure around leaving cert and all of that. Crikey.
Yeah, and I think remember at that age that their friendships, 17, 18, 19 year old, is a, like I mentioned earlier on, disembedding into an interiority phase leads into what we call an integration phase. An integration phase is like where you're launching as an emerging adult. Does that make sense? Like,
yeah.
We often say, you know, oh, you've hit 18, you're an adult. Like that, go back to when you were 18, where you're an adult at all. I mean, truthfully, it's an emerging adult when you go from 17 to 18, when you're still in school, you're hitting your first year of college. You're emerging into adulthood. And that kind of integration stage is when you're kind of cementing an understanding about future relationships and careers. I often think, you know, we think, or we have a pressure on our young people around that age, Jen, that we think they need to have solved all the problems of the world and know exactly what they're going to do with their lives, because the pressure is on to hit the right college course, to get the right career. You know, you need to, from the second you left school and you want to study medicine, you need to be a doctor 25 minutes later. It's so pressurized for them. And I think we've got to be very careful that we don't put that pressure on them. And actually, I love even hear sometimes young people saying, I'm going to take a gap year, I'm going to travel, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. Some of the best adults I know are adults in their 50s who hadn't a clue what they wanted to do until their 30s.
Yeah.
And that's okay. Or that there can be movement among college courses, or there can be movement around among careers. And I think the thing that we need to have it all nailed down and know exactly what the future is going to look like is terribly dangerous and narrow-minded. We need to be a little bit more flexible as parents.
I think, whenever I speak to you, my mind is always like racing. But it just, the message that I always, as a parent, it just seems that you know, and this, sorry, I'm kind of trying to manage my words now and thoughts, but there's just so much going on. And as a parent, if we cannot understand our own feelings and we can't slow down enough, it's like just bombs going off everywhere. So every single time we talk, it comes back to the relationship with parents, relationship with yourself, most importantly, before you start dealing with your child.
I think so. And I think also showing our kids that, you know, relationships, look, we come into this world with nothing. We leave with nothing, Jen. The only thing we have is the relationships that we have built up over the years and please God, the incredible memories that those relationships have given us. So the reality is great relationships come from great communication. And the only ownership I would try to see that we can do to assist our kids is to show them with intentional behaviors of our own that we are going to work hard, because it is hard work, to have a great marriage or to have a great relationship with their biological mother or father, or to have a great connection in general. And we're gonna strive to have connection and relationship with our kids. I often say to parents, and parents find this hard to hear, you don't have the right to challenge your child unless you have the relationship with them.
Mm.
Just because they're your kid and you're their dad or you're their mom, it needs more than that. It needs a relationship. And if you put the groundwork in the relationship, then listen, it's like any relationship. People are willing to listen to you.
I mean, they're not going to talk to you if there's no relationship there. They're not going to be telling you about the peer pressure or the anxiety or the possibly the beginning of disordered eating if they feel like you're going to bark at them.
And I suppose this is the weird bit, because we don't have the right to, because it's almost like, you know, I used to always say to, when I played rugby, I used to always talk about people I loved the sport. We used to have people watching our games who would tell you, they'd dissect your game afterwards and tell you what was good about your game, what was bad about your game. And I often would say, you know, if you're on the team with me and if you're blood, sweat and tears training with me 5 days a week and you're playing matches with me at the weekend and you have the same passion and love that I have, then you've the right to speak into my life and tell me all about my game and dissect it. I'm here. I'm going to listen to you. But if you're somebody who's in the stand with a pint of Guinness in your hand telling me what I should have done better or could have done better, no disrespect, I'm going to treat you kindly, but I'm not actually going to listen to you.
Yeah. Oh, look, gosh.
It's parents, from a parental perspective, it's exactly the same. Mm. Why would kids listen to you if you're not treating their mum well or their dad well? Why would kids listen to you if you're not really there for them? Why would kids listen to you if you're not a present parent?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, you know, so if you are one of those parents, I mean, I suppose it's important to say that a change can happen at any moment and not to beat yourself up. And look, we did a parenting course years ago. It was one of the best things we ever did. And we learned so much about ourselves, you know, never mind the relationship with the kids. You know, I think it's like we have children and then we're expected to know how to rear them. Do you know what I mean? And then when they turn teenagers, it's like, oh my God. And then you have another one and it's completely different. And then you might have three or you might have five.
They're all different. And they all have different experiences of you parenting. And you're a different parent in the context of the age you were, the environment you were in for each of your children.
That's it. Gosh. Stewie, thank you so, so much again. I always feel my mind always races when I speak to you, and loads of information and knowledge. What was the name of that book you were talking about earlier? I just want to take that down.
Oh, Dan Siegel, Dr. Dan Siegel. He's an American psychiatrist, neuroscientist who talks about, the book is called The Whole Brain Child. He's written two that are interesting, but The Whole Brain Child, he's written many, but the two that I would recommend, The Whole Brain Child, another one called No Drama Discipline. And between both of them, it goes into the context of understanding our children's brains and their neuroscience.
And was there another one about the five seats or something like that?
Oh yeah, The Five Love Languages, Gary Chapman. And you can also just go online, Jen, and you can download there's an app on it, but you can also just do an online test for your children, but also for our marriages. There's an online one for our marriages. What's your wife's love language? What's your husband's language? And go tell your husband tonight what yours is and make sure he looks after you well, because I know he does.
Oh, I'm so excited, because we've nothing else to do at the moment. That's exactly what we're going to be doing tonight. Fabulous. Patrick will be thrilled. Stewie, thanks a million. I'll chat to you soon.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.